All right, let's dive into a case today that's, well, it's a real legal thriller. Paul v. Davis.
Oh yeah, this one is a classic.
We're going to try and untangle how a shoplifting accusation ended up a landmark Supreme Court case.
A case that still has lawyers arguing today, by the way.
Definitely one you'll want to know about, especially for, your next cocktail party.
Exactly. You can really impress your friends with this one.
So what makes Paul v. Davis so fascinating?
You know, I think it's how this case just forces us to think about, like, the balance between reputation and due process, you know? And the limits of government power.
Especially in our world of social media, everything's public these days.
Right. Like, how much power should the government have to affect your reputation, especially when you consider how easily things can spread online now?
For sure. Okay, so let's set the scene. 1971, Edward Charles Davis III gets arrested for shoplifting in Louisville, Kentucky. Seems pretty standard so far, right?
Yeah, pretty typical. Except the charges against Davis, they were dismissed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So case closed. Not exactly.
Not even close. Here's where it gets wild. The police chiefs, they decide to distribute these flyers to local businesses with Davis's name and photo, labeling him an active shoplifter.
Whoa, hold on. So even though the charges were dropped,
Dropped, but they're still plastering him as a criminal.
I mean, imagine that. Being publicly branded, even though you were never convicted, it's like, how is that even?
You're right. It feels like such a fundamental violation. And it makes you think, like, did the court see it that way? Did they side with Davis?
Yeah, did they recognize this as a clear violation of his rights? What happened?
Well, Davis, he fought back, right? He sued those police chiefs.
Makes sense. Under what law, though?
He sued them under 42 USC Section 1983. It's the one that lets you hold state officials accountable when they violate your constitutional rights.
Okay, so he's saying they damaged his reputation without due process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Huge deal.
Because due process is all about fairness, right? Preventing the government from just, I don't know, taking away your life, your liberty, your property, all willy-nilly. So in this case, he's arguing his reputation is like property that the government took from him.
It is, and it's an interesting argument, legally speaking.
Yeah, I can see that. So what happened with the case?
Buckle up, because it's a wild ride. The district court, they dismissed Davis's claim.
Oh, wow. So that's it then.
Not quite. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, they reversed that decision.
Oh, a plot twist.
They said, hold on, there might be a constitutional violation here after all. So back and forth it goes, and eventually catches the eye of the Supreme Court.
Oh, wow. The highest court in the land. This is getting serious. But what did they ultimately decide? Did they think this public smearing without a conviction was a violation?
Well, the Supreme Court, they were sharply divided. Their decision in 76, it still shapes how we think about reputation and the law today.
Okay, I'm on the edge of my seat here. What was the majority's reasoning? Why'd they decide the way they did?
All right, so the majority opinion, it was written by Justice Rehnquist. And let me tell you, it sent shockwaves through the legal system. Basically, they said reputational harm by itself without some other injury, not a violation of due process.
Hold on. So just damaging someone's good name without any other consequence, that's not enough.
Not according to the majority. They are worried about opening the floodgates. Tons of lawsuits for every little instance of reputational harm. They argued you need more.
Like what? What would be more in their eyes?
They said you needed a tangible injury, like losing your job or some other legal consequence. Only then would it be a due process issue.
So they were basically saying, yeah, it's bad his reputation got hurt, but unless he can prove he actually lost something because of it,
Yeah.
not a constitutional issue.
Pretty much. And they also talked about the right to privacy, saying it was meant to protect family stuff, not public records like arrests.
Wait, slow down for a sec. So even though the charges were dropped because the arrest was public record, he has no right to privacy about it.
That's what they argued, yeah. Like, there's a line between what's private and what the government can just put out there.
Whoa. Okay, lots to unpack there. This is heavy stuff.
Oh, it gets heavier because there was also a dissent. And those justices, they did not agree.
Oh, I bet this is where things get really interesting. What did they have to say about all this?
Oh, the dissent. They came out swinging. They were like, hold up, reputation is a fundamental liberty interest, like straight up.
Yeah, I can see why they'd be upset. It's your good name, you know?
Exactly. And they argued the government shouldn't be able to just trash someone's reputation without any consequences, especially if they were cleared of any wrongdoing.
Yeah, it does seem like a dangerous precedent if they can just, like, throw accusations around with no repercussions.
Right. And the dissent, they were worried about that. big time. They were like, hey, this could have a chilling effect on free speech, on the whole idea of innocent until proven guilty.
That makes sense. Like, if people are afraid to speak out against the government because they might get smeared.
Exactly. It could create this, like, atmosphere of fear. People would be afraid to challenge authority.
So we've got this clash of perspectives. The majority worried about too many lawsuits, wanting to protect state power. And the dissent fiercely defending individual rights, the importance of reputation.
It's a classic legal battle, for sure. Really gets to the heart of what it means to live in a free society. Like, where do we draw the line?
And the legacy of Paul V. Davis. It's still with us today.
Oh, yeah. Especially because of something called the Stigma Plus test.
Stigma Plus. Okay, now we're getting into the nitty-gritty. What's that all about? How does it work in real life?
So the Stigma Plus test, it came directly from that majority decision. It basically says, to sue for reputational harm caused by the government under that law we talked about, the 42 U.S.C. 1983.
Right, the one Davis used.
You got to prove two things. First, your reputation was actually harmed by what the government did.
Makes sense. But that's not all.
Nope. You also got to prove you suffered some kind of tangible injury because of it.
So, like, it's not enough to just show the government said bad things about you, even if they were false.
Right. You got to show that those statements caused a real measurable loss, like you got fired or denied some benefit.
Okay. So that plus factor, the tangible injury, that becomes crucial.
Absolutely. So think about Edward Charles Davis III. If he had lost his job because of those flyers calling him an active shoplifter,
then he might have had a stronger case under this Stigma Plus test.
Exactly. But without that tangible injury, it's much tougher. And this test, it's been a huge E factor in cases about reputation ever since. Especially for things like public accusations, employment disputes.
Oh, I bet. It even applies to things today, like getting put on a watch list or a sex offender registry.
You got it. Because those have very real consequences that go beyond just hurting your reputation.
It's kind of double-edged sword, isn't it? The Stigma Plus test. On the one hand, it sets a clear standard, prevents the courts from being flooded with lawsuits.
True. But on the other hand,
it might make it really hard for people to get justice when their reputation's been unfairly damaged, even if they haven't suffered that specific tangible loss.
That's the heart of the debate. Did Paul V. Davis strike the right balance? And it's a debate that's still raging on in legal circles today.
It's a tough one,
yeah,
for sure. Raises all sorts of questions about the power of the government, the importance of reputation. Like, what does justice even mean in these situations?
It does. And as our world changes, gets more interconnected, especially with technology blurring the lines between public and private, those questions are only getting more urgent, more complicated.
Oh, yeah. Think about how fast information spreads online these days. One tweet, one social media post, gone viral. And it can wreck someone's reputation in a flash, even if it's completely false.
Exactly. And that's one of the biggest challenges we face. Does a test from a pre-internet world, like Stigma Plus, still work when damage can happen so quickly and on such a huge scale?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a different world now than when Paul V. Davis happened. Back then, a flyer was a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
Now it's all online. Stuff can go global in seconds.
And that's the thing. The potential for damage, it's exponentially bigger with the internet. One little accusation, a photo taken out of context, a story, even if it's totally false, it can spread like wildfire online, reach millions of people.
And it can be devastating to someone's life, personal and professional.
Yeah.
So it makes you think, does this Stigma Plus test from, what, the 70s,
yeah,
does it really have the power to deal with this kind of online harm?
Yeah.
Especially when it's often anonymous.
That's the big question. I mean, how do you prove tangible injury when the damage is so, so widespread, so hard to measure?
Exactly. It's like, what if someone's the target of a smear campaign online? They might not get fired. But what about the stress, the anxiety, the relationships that get strained?
And that fear of, like, what's next? What are they going to post about me today?
Exactly. How do you measure that kind of harm?
Yeah, right. It's complicated. There's no easy answer. Some legal scholars, they're saying we need to rethink Stigma Plus altogether, like maybe broaden what counts as a tangible injury to include emotional distress, especially if you can document it medically.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like the law is trying to catch up to technology here, trying to force a square peg in a round hole, applying a test from before the internet to, well, this whole digital mess.
Totally. And it's not even always about the government directly causing the harm.
Right, right. But they might still be contributing to the environment where this stuff flourishes online.
Exactly. Like, think about algorithms. They can push the most sensational content, even if it's not true. Or the fact that there aren't clear rules for these social media platforms makes it hard to hold them accountable for spreading false information.
That's a good point. And that leads to, well, more questions about what the government's role should be here. How do they protect people from online harm, but also protect free speech? Encourage innovation. It's a tough one.
It's a balance, for sure. So what do we do? Do we get rid of Stigma Plus or try to update it for the internet age? These are the debates happening in courts, in law schools, everywhere.
Some heavy stuff to ponder. I like the idea of considering emotional distress as a tangible injury, especially if it's documented. Or maybe, I don't know, hold platforms more responsible for what they're hosting.
Definitely options worth exploring. It feels like we need some like serious legal creativity here to keep pace with technology if we really want to protect people's rights online.
Okay, so I think we've done a pretty deep dive on Paul V. Davis today. Covered the facts, the opinions, the Stigma Plus test, how it's all playing out in this digital world.
It's a case that just keeps sparking debate. It really makes you think about reputation, due process, the limits of power, you know?
And remember, folks, this is just the tip of the iceberg. Keep digging into this topic. See where Paul V. Davis has been cited. Look into the arguments about Stigma Plus. Think about how it applies to new technologies. It's fascinating stuff.
Because ultimately, the law doesn't just exist in a vacuum. It affects everyone. And it's constantly being shaped by the cases that come before it, by the conversations we have about justice, fairness, what kind of society we want to build.
Very well said. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.